This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome. I'm Carol Crist. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education, and I'm delighted to see you here for this talk by one of our visiting scholars, Stephanie Beyer. She is a doctoral student in sociology at the University of Bamberg in Germany. Her thesis is Transformation of Higher Education Systems, a comparison of the university systems and academic career paths in the USA and Germany. It's really a fascinating study of career paths in science and how these career paths are not only different in the two countries, but differently shaped by the kinds of structures of university and employment in the two countries. She's particularly interested in the consequences of the changing university budget cuts and increasing competition in Germany and the U.S. on scientific careers. She's conducted a number of interviews when she's here. She's also been an active participant in the Gardner Seminar, and we've so much enjoyed having her here as a colleague and are eager to hear about her research today. So, Stephanie.
Okay, thank you very much, Carol. And yeah, first of all, I would like to use this opportunity to thank you, Carol, very much for having me at the center and for giving me the opportunity to give this talk here. And also, I really would like to thank Judd King, who has been advising me and mentoring me, especially within the field of chemistry. Last but not least, I want to thank Anne McLachlan for always supporting me and giving me a lot of feedback on everything and the great discussions we had. So, okay, now I'm going to start, and I entitled my presentation today Homo Prestigious University Status. Oh, what did I? Homo Prestigious University Status and the Academic Career. And with this, I want to take two different perspectives. And first of all, one of the perspectives will be a structural perspective and looking at departments and the structures of different departments in the U.S. And the second one would be from a more individual perspective, perceptions, how people or people within academia perceive their chances shaped through departments, more or less. So I also subtitled it Divisions and Visions Within Academia. So to give a short introduction, this is, as Carol mentioned already, part of my thesis in sociology. And I also would like to emphasize that it's still work in progress. It's not final results. It's some results, but it's not completely done yet. And I still want to go for some interviews and include those. So all in all, I'm doing a comparison of Germany and the U.S. academic systems. Because why is that important? Because there have been so many reforms and political changes going on in Germany or in Europe. And they always look at the U.S. system more or less. And they had some initiatives, like, for example, one which you're, I think, familiar with might be the Excellence Initiative, which was going on also in Germany and in several countries. And so what they tried or what they are trying to do, for example, in Germany, is to channel funding differently to create more visible universities. But nonetheless, that's not the topic I'm going to talk today about. Today I'm going to focus on the U.S., and present my findings on the U.S. So it has been, it's quite clear for a long time that in the U.S. prestige of a department or university is very, very important, and it shapes more or less a future academic career. And that rankings, they also have been going on for quite a while, which is, for example, in Europe or Germany, it's quite a newer thing for people. But here it has been going on for a while. And, for example, Val Burris, he did some analyses on the exchange of PhD students or after they gained their PhD within the American system. He called it as a caste system, more or less. And so a pretty static system. And also, why is this important? Because we had the economic crisis after 2008, and this also led to some changes within the field, and less funding available. And this might be now interesting, how does this shape the perceptions of future academics, or also, of course, professors and so on. And what I'm going to focus on, or what I decided to do, is I'm going to focus on two disciplines, which in this case are sociology and chemistry. So the results I'm presenting now are mainly about sociology, but I also include chemistry. First of all, moving a little bit away from just the rankings, and it was this analysis. I did this with a colleague of mine, Nilgun Masiterani from Bamberg, and me. We were inspired by Valburis, and we also did a network analysis. And what this basically is, it consists of two things, more or less: the starting point of an academic career and the full professorship. So this is data showing where a person got or received the PhD in sociology. It's only departments on sociology, within sociology, and then where he or she got a position as a full professor. So this is data on current full professors in sociology in the US. And what it basically says is that universities or departments within the center, they produce the most, or they have produced the most current, most of the current professors within sociology. So you can see the highlighted departments are, one could say, the most important departments in the US for sociology, because they have produced young academics or full professors, so to speak. And one could say that those in the center are most important, and then you have like departments that are in between, but also departments within the periphery, I want to call it. And why is this important for my analysis? I use this indicator, being in the center or at the periphery, for further analysis, but I will go into that in a little bit. So, and now I just want to briefly go into what I hear called analytic lens. From which kind of theory am I coming from? And for my analysis, I'm going to use Pierre Bourdieu's relational sociology and some of his concepts, which are kind of connected to each other, and we'll talk about it in a little bit. But his kind of approach is very interesting, because he does not differentiate between structure and agent, so to speak. He says both is important, both, because the structure shapes the agent, and the agent might shape the structure. And so he does not make a, as he would say, maybe artificial distinction, but he looks at what he calls subjective and objective moments, or structure, as you will, and the subjective point of view. Or he also uses expressions like the visions and visions. So the visions as a structure or a position one has within society, and then the vision one has from that kind of structure. And he says it's important because there's always a correspondence between objective and subjective structures. And the task of sociology, he says, with this kind of, for, to my mind, most important notions, is to find out what are the principles of differentiation within a, he says, social space. So I'm just going to briefly explain what he means by this. He says, like, in modern societies, they are highly differentiated, and you can go ahead and analyze maybe a society with the notion of the social space, and to view or to look at the society as being a social space. And since it's highly differentiated, there are several fields within each society. And here he says, for example, you have the political field, the economic field, artistic field, and so on, but also the academic field, scientific field. And this is what I'm concentrating on right now. And within this academic field, there are different kind of capitals that are important, and people within this academic field, within those different departments in the US, for example, they have different attributes or different amounts of capitals, and there are different in a different hierarchy, more or less, one could say. And so that also he connects it very closely to the habitus. And what he means by habitus, more or less, is he says that those are systematic dispositions or schemes of perceptions or schemes of appreciation. So what a person finds, for example, what he or she has a taste for, what the preferences are for something, for example, for topics to work on within academia, or expectations of the future or aspirations, where one would like to go. And also, which is still very connected, is the trajectory within this academic field. So that means, where is someone coming from? For example, he would claim that it makes a difference if someone starts, for example, at Harvard and then moves on to the University of Utah, for example, or any other university. So it makes a difference how your trajectory within this academic space or academic field looks like. And so, looking at my research design, how did I account for those things? First of all, to account for the structural divisions, I used a method that is called multiple correspondence analysis, and I conducted it on departments. So the analysis of interest, or the units of interest, are departments of the more or less top 100 universities. And in this case, I used universities or departments within sociology that were ranked by the US News World Report. And I used those variables for the multiple correspondence analysis. And I will briefly explain in a little bit what the multiple correspondence analysis does. But I used indicators of the ranking, amount of funding for every department, if the department has members of the National Academy of Sciences, for example, the number of citations, the department size, if the department or the university is public or private, and also what I showed you within the network analysis, the production of academics, and how if the university or the department is in the center or in the periphery. And I analyzed this with the multiple correspondence analysis. And what does it mean? A little bit technical note might be that it's a quantitative method that converts categorical data into a spatial structure. So we will see a map in a little bit, and then it might be a little bit more illustrated. And what you can visualize is you get data on a map, and similar units, in this case departments, similar departments are clustered together. And distances within this map reflect similarities, or huge differences would be reflected by a long distance within the map. And what it also does is it reduces the complexity of data and gives you the opportunity to look at two axes and dimensions, what the underlying dimensions of that structure is. It might get more visible in a little bit. And then after that, MCA, I performed a cluster analysis to just map out what are the most important or the three most distinctive clusters within this analysis. And after that, I moved on to the subjective moment, as Bourdieu would say. And based on the results of those two analyses, which gave me kind of a departmental clusterings, I conducted semi-structured interviews. And I talked to 40 people based on the positions within the academic field. So I looked for people in each cluster to get their visions of their career and what they think is possible and how their career might look like. And I talked to PhD students and also faculty, because I wanted to cover the full spectrum, not just young academics, but also people who have their full professorship or even emeritus, to get a range of views. And then I also reconstructed their career trajectories. Okay, and what might be important for the interviews, I obtained an IRB. So mapping distinctions in U.S. academia. To summarize, first of all, I reconstructed an academic field on a macro level, and I'm going to visualize this in a little bit. And then, I looked for the three main clusters, or it was suggested that the analysis suggested three main clusters. And then on this basis, I tried to look at the visions of the people and how they shape their understanding of academia. So, and now we're going to move to the results. I think this needs some explanation. But first of all, what you can see here, this is the result of the correspondence analysis. And what is plotted are the departments. And also to get an idea of maybe how important the rankings are, I highlighted this by color. But it's not the clusters yet. The clusters look a little bit different, but not too different. And so you have one axis here. This is dimension one, and the variance, 60% of the variance of the differences within the data is explained by this major axis. That would be one interpretation. Now one has to go into what does it mean. And the second dimension explains 14%. And I'm going to go ahead and say, so the cluster analysis suggested that this is one major cluster. And now I'm going to describe it by the characteristics I used for it. So usually, and this is the second, and this is the third cluster. So the first cluster is usually, or would be characterized by being a top-ranked university. So a top-ranked, what I understand by top-ranked, I used 1 to 10. And then they also receive mainly very high NSF funding. And this is only for sociology so far. And also high research and development funding. They are also founders of the Association of American Universities because it was founded in 1900. And there were 14 universities who founded this association. And they are, I think it's even all of them might be in the top cluster. And and they also have very high number of citations. They do have members of the who are part of the or who belong to the National Academy of Sciences, and they are central within the network analysis. And the tendency is that most of them or some of them are private institutions. So how does cluster two look like? Cluster two is ranked somewhere in between, so to say. It's ranked 11 to 30 mostly. They receive medium NSF funding and medium or even high research and development funding. They are also mainly members of AAU, but they joined after 1900. And they have a medium amount of citations and are in between in the network analysis, so to say, and mostly private institutions. Cluster 3 can be categorized by ranked below 30 and receiving a lower amount of NSF funding, also lower R&D, not being a member of AAU, having lower citations, and do have a peripheral position within the network analysis, and are mostly public universities. Yeah. So then, after that, after mapping out the structure of the three clusters of the departments within U.S. sociology, I moved further and I tried to dig deeper into the three clusters and conducted interviews. So I'm not only looking at the positions, but also at the position takings of people. And again, I used the semi-structured interviews at 7 institutions in the U.S. And I covered the spectrum of PhD, assistant professor, associate professor, full professor. And what I talked about with faculty or future faculty is about their career trajectory, to be able to map it within social space or the academic space. And we talked about the importance of rankings, how they perceive rankings, how much people or faculty talk about it at departments, and how they perceive prestige differences, and about the importance of funding, also about their possible future, if they were PhD students, of course, and the past for full professors, for example, and changes, if they have perceived changes within the field, especially after 2008. And very importantly, about their perceived, self-perceived autonomy and how autonomous the department might be and what that might be connected to and so on. Yeah, so and now I'm going to read out some or show you some to get a, that you get a sense of what people said, what positions they took. I'm going to read out some quotes and summarize them at the end again, but yeah. So, for example, when we talked about prestige at Cluster 1, the top-ranked universities, a PhD student in sociology, he, for example, he said, "I went to the big sociology conference years ago and happened to be sitting next to some graduate student from some small university in Texas, and they saw my name tag and just quieted down like, 'Oh, you're in a different class than we are. We are not going to talk to you.' They got really quiet afterwards. I mean, they were polite, but yeah, it's like it wasn't my intention to shut them down. It is just that it is not my fault that I come from Cluster 1, and it's not like your fault that your university is ranked lower than mine." So here we can see, for example, that at a very early stage within the U.S., prestige and the departmental prestige is just perceived by the name tag at the conference. And so what the PhD student also said, because I showed him my map of the correspondence analysis and talked about it with him, and he said, yeah, people have a sense of your map, basically, in their head. So they just see the department, and then they have a kind of sense of belonging, as one might want to put it. And, moving ahead to still Cluster 1, but about autonomy, a professor in chemistry from the top-ranked department. He said, many people change the nature of their research to fit into an avenue where funding is available. They would lose autonomy. They would not necessarily work on whatever they would create in their own mind, but they would work on something which is related to a source of funding. I never had to do that. I was always working at things that almost no one was working on. Yeah. And connected to this, if we look at Cluster 2, the I might want to call them in-betweeners, and when they talk, well, here's one example of someone talking about autonomy of the department. It was an assistant professor within sociology, and he said, "Is there more pressure to bring in money? Definitely. I think that when you're applying at the sort of top five, they do whatever they want to do. They never hire anybody who's not from an elite institution. I had a friend on the job market. She had like no publications, but she was from a top department, and she got the top 20 job." And then he moved on, saying, "Whereas when you're looking at the top 20, people would be going out with four or five publications. So whether or not you have a grant at the top department, I'd say they don't care. They are going to hire whoever they want. I think if you are going out for a job at Cluster 2, then I think it matters quite a bit." So, and then Cluster 3, for example, talking about rankings with a PhD student in sociology. And this person said, "Yeah, it's in the back of our mind all the time, especially as graduate students. When we had our first class with a department chair here, he decided to let us all know where our department is ranked and where we, and that we not going to get jobs at certain schools. It was a very dark day." So, and again, prestige and rankings within Cluster 3. And again, here you can see the difference of the number of publications that are perceived. I think they definitely have an influence on me. I think that's one of the reasons I have this shoot for a high goal as far as publications. But I'm going to have more making up to do. And people argue, not necessarily. I have to laugh, because people who say that are usually coming from pretty top-ranked programs. But it's easy for you to say that, right? It's like being a white male and saying race and gender doesn't matter. Perhaps you just don't see the advantage that you had. So I think ranking definitely does matter." And then, now to get the a different view from someone who attended also the conferences, a big conference in, within sociology, but from the opposite kind of perspective, this person said, "I have heard from other people that attend the conferences that it seems like people just go and they look at your name tag, and if you are not from one of those schools, they don't want to talk to you. So that makes more or less, one can see with this, that it's clearly, yeah, that there's clearly what you might call the habitus or position takings is going on also within the individual level. And now, talking about autonomy and cluster three, a professor of chemistry, he said, I may choose to work in an area that doesn't have any funding, or I may choose to change my area of research in order to find funding. That's my decision, whatever it is that I value. I've picked problems which I think are important and problems that I value, so I don't feel like people are telling me what to do. If you do what I'm doing now, going to applied research, the goal is pretty restricted, pretty clear-cut. People can become and feel like they are being part of a machine, you know, not really independent. But that's the area I've chosen to work in. That's my choice. And what was interesting here is that when I asked at the beginning of my interviews, I asked them, so how do you perceive autonomy or your own autonomy? And of course, a tenured professor would always say, very high, I can do whatever I want. And then, yeah, but asking professors sometimes about the practical, their practical autonomy, I would call it. So what they apply for, or what they, in what fields they move, or what topics they work on. There, in practice, there seems a different kind of choice of topics. So that might be framed by the departments, what the department values, and so on. And then topics and relevance in cluster three. A student in sociology said, here is a focus on criminology, and that seems one of the better funded areas in sociology, which is part of the reason I picked the areas of focus. Whenever I came here, I was like, okay, what are the two areas that seem to have the most funding and are most marketable? Criminology is one, and quantitative method seems to be the other, so that's what I'd like to combine. One of the things that hurts, and then, interestingly, he moved on to the question of what is relevant within sociology, or what you can do within sociology. And then he said, one of the things that hurts sociology is, I think, we get caught up in our ivory tower a lot. So I think being able to work with public health and criminology and criminal justice seem to be a little bit more promising, in the sense that there is a higher hope, it seems, like getting effective policy passed and kind of feeling like sociology is making a difference. And after that, what I also did is I, within the multiple correspondence analysis, again, you are able to also plot topics within it passively. And so I looked at criminology, for example, and it turns out that criminology is mostly researched by cluster three departments, as opposed to cluster one departments. They usually do not go into criminology that much. They rather work on theory or so not applied things, theory or comparative sociology, historical sociology, ethnography, things like this. And this is clearly visible within the structural data, but also the position takings here. And then one more thing on what might be called topic tailoring is that that a PhD student in chemistry said, because when I asked the person if he or she wants to continue with a postdoc after the PhD, or what he or she would do if she wanted to or he wanted to, that person said, choose a topic that other people think is relevant. Choose a hot topic, like a topic that is really popular. And another one said, I need to tailor my research to best fit getting funded, I applied for NSF once and I did not get it, and it was really struggling to get funding, even at this level. I think it definitely comes down to having a look at adjustments and figuring out what is really going to get funded. If you can't get funded, you might as well just go to a small school and just teach a little bit on the side. So, yeah. And then another, so I'm almost done with the quotes. But another very interesting thing, and this is which might highlight the conceptualization of the trajectory and why it's important to use it also, to look at it in the academic space, is, for example, There are a lot of professors. Of course, they started out at a very cluster one, so to say, and then they got a position at a cluster three. And this person is an example of that. And we were talking about the difference, how people act within the department if they are might be from a highly ranked department. And then he said, well, guess what? You are not at Stanford anymore. That is like a college student that's still talking about all the fun things they did in high school and their student government and what they got at their SAT. They haven't made an identity transformation to being happy with where they are at. And then what was really remarkable, I did not talk about work-life balance or anything like this. I never asked professors about it, but professors from Cluster 3, they usually came up with this, and then they said things like, so, I was able to be very productive, and I have a kind of happy balance of work and family and life outside of work. And even a PhD student, he said, I really don't want that sort of career where you are working until absolute exhaustion. I have hobbies, I have a social life, and I'm going to keep having those things. I want to put research out, but I don't want to drive myself crazy. And then thirdly, an assistant professor in sociology said, standards are higher in terms of not only just the quantity of publications, also the quality. I think that causes a lot more kind of permanent anxiety at these more elite schools, at least my friends that have been hired. And they all seem to me more stressed out. All right, and lastly, cluster three about departmental autonomy now. At this department, we have to get a hire approved, but only for specific positions, which was one of the culture shocks coming here. So my sense is that a lot of the autonomy at a school like this is eroded because there are so many projects and five-year plans that are handed down from the provost to move this department up. It usually has some ridiculous title like Striving for Excellence, where we have a research line that opens up, but it has to be within this university initiative, so climate change or immigration or something like that. So that ties our hands what the department can look like. And opposed to that, for example, there was also someone else from a top department, and he said that usually they can look for whoever they want to hire. They are not restricted in any case. This is also the opposition within the social space. And here it is again. The structure, and now I want to implement the position takings we were listening to now and what might be typical for the clusters. So we have the three clusters again. And looking at cluster one, the top universities, they maintain more or less practical autonomy, although they, of course, for example, in chemistry, you have applied chemistry also at top departments, and they also apply for funding. But still, there might be more. So the tendency I got out of the interviews, and I might be wrong there, but they still are able to maintain more practical autonomy and to define the topics they really want to research on and define the relevant topics within the whole academic field, more or less. And then they have the highest departmental autonomy as well, and they work on different topics, for example, in sociology theory, historical sociology or ethnography, for example. And they produce young academics for all clusters. So, for example, PhDs or people who receive their PhD here, they can get a position here. They also get a position mainly here or in the third cluster. But the goal would be, of course, to get a position here. But they produce for all clusters. And then cluster two. They are the elite striving departments, more or less, so they want to move up the ranking ladder, maybe. And they implement strategies to do that. And so what one of the persons said, he said, so it's the amount of publications is important, the quality. So whereas at cluster one, if there's a person who had done like very original work, which is very important and to have creative people, creative work, as they label it, you can get a position without publications, but to a less extent than that would be possible here. And it's important for them to move up the rankings, and funding is very important. And young academics go more or less into cluster three. They mostly, if they get a job within academia, they would be, or they would have to move more or less to this cluster. And cluster three, so yeah, might be like the mass department. They are also producing PhDs, of course, but not so much for academia or not for this kind of academic top 100 space. They work on different topics, like more applied topics, applied sociology, like criminology, for example. And the impact of sociology is important, like the practical relevance. And they emphasize work-life balance, which is very important to them. And they do have, to some extent, to tailor their research. And young academics, what I mentioned before, they have to leave, I would say, this kind of space. I mean, they also find, of course, academic jobs, but not within the research one space. Yeah, so to come to a conclusion, one might argue, or I want to argue, that both is important, the objective structure, so the structure where one is placed, and I would call it a prestige economy, and rankings and funding is very tight, but there is a correspondence or homology how the individuals perceive things. So there's their conceptualization of autonomy, which differs from cluster to cluster, I would say, and they work on a very different variation of topics. And for PhD students, their perception or the perceived chances of a future academic position in the field is also very different. And then what I call, they might be rationalizations. For example, they explain why they're in the third cluster because they have more an emphasis on work-life balance. And all in all, coming back to maybe my lenses I was using, Pierre Bourdieu's theory, there might be, or it seems like, that there is a homology of positions and dispositions, but it's not static, because there's also, what is really important is the trajectory within this academic field, so where one comes from which kind of clustered department. And then there might be the question of erosion of autonomy to some degree. But my finding would be it depends highly on the position in the field, in a cluster. So one could not say in general, there's an erosion of autonomy within US academia. I would rather say it depends on the social position in the field or the academic position in the field. And all in all, what I did not show as much, but within the quotes, there was also a huge impact of the economic crisis. So people, especially young academics, have more pressure and to publish more and so on and so on. But I did not cover this within here. And so all in all, one could say homo prestigious. yes, I think prestige is a fundamental principle of differentiation within the US and the academic system that clusters the field, but also shapes similar attitudes or habitus, and one might want to put it within those clusters. And all in all, I want to thank you for listening, and I'm very open to critique, so it's still work in progress. If you have any remarks, let me know.
Thank you a lot. I'm not in sociology, so I'm really an outsider to this. Can I ask, could you please tell us more about the comparison about this with the situation in Germany? Because comparative perspective might be more interesting. I mean, even more interesting.
Okay. Yeah, the thing is, I did not do the complete analysis for Germany. But what I can say is that, of course, rankings, they have been coming up like maybe, 10 years now, 5 to 10 years, and they gained a lot of relevance. And funding is changing, so the ways universities or departments are funded is changing. And my suggestion or hypothesis would be it has an effect, it will have a big effect, but it's not... first of all, I have to work on that, and still the effects might not be that clustered. So if you would plot universities in Germany, by far you would not have the prestige economy, not at all. It depends highly on the field. And here it's for chemistry, because I also did it for chemistry, which I did not show. But it's, of course, it's different, but it's the even the, when I go back to the, let me just go back to that axis. For example, this explains 60%, this prestige economy, as I would call it, or the rankings and prestigious variables. But for chemistry, that was even more tied. It was like 70% or something, I believe. So funding and prestige, for example, was even more tied together. Yeah, that would be my interpretation. But in Germany, it's not that... So rankings are not really that important. I mean, it's increasing, but not as important still. Yeah.
I see. Yeah, so I have another point to share with the audience. So in the discipline of economics, I think last year or the second last year, I mean, there's a research quantitatively showing that the students, the top student from less top-ranked department performs consistently much better than most of the students from the very top-ranked departments. So that's what's happening in economics. At least many economists believe in that. So do you think there's something similar happening in sociology or other field?
Yeah. Yeah, that's an important question, of course. But it's the thing is, it's not that I want to map out abilities of persons. Of course, they, you know, it varies, I would argue, of course, it does. But maybe one has also to look at the complete trajectory, where does it start, and then we could go back to high school and things like this, SAT scores or GRE scores and so on and so on. So it's, of course, the top universities, I would argue, and this is also true for sociology, chemistry and so on, I think maybe for every field you want to look at, that they only want to have the top students in the field, of course. Yeah. So there is a variation, I think. Yes.
Because if you can answer that question, then... You can say something about the situation now, whether it's kind of good for the society. I mean, so in the efficiency terms.
Yeah, but that's of course, that's a different question than a scientific one, yeah.
Hi, thanks for an interesting talk. As it happens, many years ago, in a galaxy far, far away, I did my own dissertation here at Berkeley on the American professoriate. I had a sample of 19,000 professors from 25 different disciplines. And one thing that really stood out to me, it was the differences between disciplines in a dimension you might call mobility. And that this was when I did my dissertation, funding for the biological sciences was exploding like mad. And as a result, funding through the peer review mechanism made its way to a much larger number of the American professoriate in the biological sciences than it did in either physics and math or in the social sciences and humanities. And I was struck by the fact that the difference this made in publication rates, many more faculty in the biological sciences at that time were doing research and publishing. And it would seem to me that although the prestige dimension that you're talking is kind of a constant that's going to happen in every field, the funding can shift from time to time. And in the biological sciences, it appeared that mobility and in your first chart where people moved from one institution to another, I suspect you might find larger differences between disciplines where there are more and less funding overall to be had. Because the surprising thing is that in fields like the social sciences and humanities, this kind of severe stratification within the academic discipline seems to be much stronger, or at least that was my conclusion at the time, and I wonder about your reaction.
Okay. I'd like to offer a different perspective on autonomy.
Yes, please.
And I can only speak for natural sciences and engineering, but the the freedom that you have to choose research in those fields is very much decided by federal agencies, the funding programs of federal agencies. So in a sense, the Cluster 3 people have more autonomy because they're not getting funded. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Cluster 1 schools, NIH, NSF, Department of Defense agencies, they define the research. There's typically, if you have a reputation in your field of research, you have the ability to tailor the approach and the scope of the work, but the general programmatic direction is not yours to choose. The other thing I would wonder about, the characteristics that define your cluster groups, they're really distributions. They're not really fixed points, because I'd say in departments at Berkeley, you'll find a distribution of these qualities that you are speaking of. So in a sense, I think there's an overlap, but certainly between the clusters 1 and 2. You'd find people in my department that were more like cluster 2 than cluster 1, even though they were still at Berkeley.
Thanks, this was fascinating, but I want to make it even more complicated than it's already been raised, and that has to do with change over time. Mm-hmm. You said this wasn't static, and it may not be static internally, but it's static as a program. Are there changes among these institutions over time in terms of where they cluster? Mm-hmm. Did you raise that question? You looked at it at a particular slice of time.
Yes. That is great. So I looked at a particular, it was for 2010-11, I think, the data. But that is what Val Burris wrote about. He showed within his analysis that this is quite he explained it as a caste system. Mm-hmm. That is a little bit of variation. I mean, he looked at sociology, and you could do this for other departments, of course. But not so much as one would expect. So the top 20 are more or less kind of really fixed. There are some changes. Some departments move up a little bit and some move down, and some exchanges, but it's not really fluid.
So the changes are that people may move from cluster 3 to cluster 2 and cluster 2 to cluster 1, or even from 3 to 1, but that the institutions are kind of fixed in place?
More or less, yes. Not completely
So once you have a reputation, that reputation will carry you, because you'll get all the good graduate students, and you'll get all the good funding, and therefore your chances of shifting your position in terms of reputation, in terms of prestige, is very tiny. It doesn't happen.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah.
Could you respond to the issue of differentiation across disciplines? Have you noticed differences in how wide the net gets cast in some disciplines? Show any differences? That's what I'm asking.
So I only had the two, chemistry and sociology.
Do you have a chemistry chart?
Not here, no. Oh, no. Yeah, okay. But I can show you another time if you want.
I'm a sociologist. Since I don't think anyone has been heard from on the topic of study. When I entered the field in the 60s, sociology was one of the most popular undergraduate disciplines. Recently, I asked a good friend of mine who was chairman of the department at Stanford, and he told me, we have almost no undergraduate majors. So maybe this whole structure that you're displaying is built on not even sand, but air, or absence of people coming up, so it all must be an artifact of the past for sociology. On the other hand, I'm going to be teaching in science, technology, and society. That's now the second largest major at Stanford. Amazing. Who would have thought that would happen? A humanistically oriented discipline, but in connection to important trends in society. Actually doing what sociology should be doing. When I asked my friend, why doesn't Stanford have a course on sociology of Silicon Valley? oh, no, that would be getting too close to what is happening in society. That's really not the place for an elite sociology department. He told me the university considered it, even spent a few million dollars investigating the possibility, but in the end decided not to do so. Now, on the other hand, I recently had the pleasure of teaching at the Max Weber Institute at the University of Heidelberg in a friend's course, which had redesigned sociology at Heidelberg, at least for one part of it. This is a course that had group projects, students organized in teams, investigating different issues. The objective was to come up with proposals, both for funding and for change in society. So I would say there is hope for sociology at Heidelberg. Stanford, I'm not sure. Berkeley, of course.
Well, first of all, thank you, Stephanie, for your talk. It was fascinating and revealing picture of our academy. And it's like a comment and a question. What brought me here was the expectation of any contact you might make between what happens here in the U.S. and what happens, or at least I hear it happens, in Germany in terms of education in general, especially in terms of Bildung. From now, I say I'm sorry because I'm not from the field. I'm an applied linguist from Brazil, and I'm a visiting scholar here too. And, well, the thing is, as far as I know, in Germany, the educational system is or used to be based on the concept of Bildung, on developing with individuals, the idea, especially the capacity, the ability of agency and freedom. So education in general was based on those milestones, let's say. What it seems to me, and I agree with the colleague which said that there is a constant for the cluster one departments and universities, and I would say even a little bit more, no matter the field, these departments are cluster one because they comply with the rules of more prestigious areas in terms of science. Applied linguistics is not a prestigious area in Brazil, and I think it's not here either. And I'm sorry, sociology in terms of big science is not seen as so, although it is. In terms of funding, people try to be cluster one, and maybe they betray the roots of their fields, let's say. But it's just an assumption I'm making. So my question is, would it be correct to say that universities, departments, and individuals that fit in cluster three, mm-hmm. that even mention the importance of work and life balance, would be closer to the von Humboldt's original idea of Bildung in terms of freedom and agency, as opposed to cluster one for sure, and maybe cluster two, who are fighting mm-hmm. to comply with neoliberal academic demands? Mm-hmm. I would like to hear from that. Sorry.
Okay.
The last thing. I would like to have your references because I'm very interested in what you're doing. Okay. Thank you.
Sure. So that is a very interesting question because just a few days ago I was also wondering because I did not have like the solution to this kind of axis and what this axis might be explaining. I'm still looking for this or trying to figure it out. So this is the prestige and this is what is it? I ask myself. And it might be, I mean, it's not within the data, so to say, but one might be able to interpret it as kind of an autonomy would maybe not be freedom to go after specific topics. And they do have autonomy because they can hire whoever they want, at least in this case. And but also, of course, you're saying they might be going after some hot topics, but also they might be the ones who define the hot topics because they have the power to do so, more or less. But those, and what I wanted to say to ask to answer your question. This might also imply the, and that would fit your idea maybe, imply the degree of freedom to work on a very specific topic. So they are pressured because they want to move up the academic or the ranking ladder. They want to go there, but they don't strive to go there because they know they can't more or less go there. The departments, I'm talking about the departments right now. And so they are here and they do applied research and they, so then the narrative would be, okay, so it's important, especially within sociology, and we can have applications and so on. But yes, I agree to some extent in comparing it to Germany or to the concept of Bildung, that might also be, yeah, I will think about it. Thank you very much.
But we have time for one, I guess there are two more questions, and then we have to stop. Sorry, I think there was one in the back someplace. Yes,
sir. I'm wondering if you might consider a follow-up study.
Mm-hmm.
And you may even have the fodder for the stimuli for the study already. So it strikes me, especially from the one comment with the person who was sitting with other people from less prestigious institutions, that it'd be interesting to see if more neutral observers could tell where someone is. So you might take interviews with people talking about mm-hmm. the nature of sociology, the nature of chemistry. Mm-hmm. Maybe you already have this in your extensive interviews. And you'd have to sanitize it out for things like, well, I just got this big NSF grant, of course, or here at Fancy University, as opposed to Podunk, you know, we do this. Mm-hmm. So if you sanitize that, you know, to take out these sort of markers of status and then provide it to neutral observers, either people in the field or even just plain folks, and ask them, you know, who's sort of got it, you know, who understands the field, who understands, or who, maybe even a measure of swagger, if that matter. It might be interesting to see mm-hmm. if there's like an objective element that is transmitted, whether based on merit or just happy chance for the individual. I wonder if you'd consider that.
Not yet. I showed the analysis to people within the field, but and let them position within the field, or I showed them kind of similar to those plots. I showed them plots, and then I asked them, so where would you place your department? And was very accurate, I would say. Not everybody was completely accurate, but very close to that, yeah. But that is a very good idea, to just go outside the field and then also ask people, yeah, outside the field. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'd like to follow up on the dynamics and reputation. I would be curious how people actually perceive the rankings, because there is a growing range of rankings. And some, notably, recycle reputation, because they are based on what people think are mm-hmm. very good departments. And I'm not always sure that we have that knowledge, actually, at a global level. I'm always very hesitant to give that sort of answers in any case. So in those rankings, reputation may become a self-fulfilling prophecy. So that's one thing to probably unpack, if possible. And the other one is the comparison with Europe or Germany, if you like. I think the dynamics may be bigger there, notably in Germany with the Excellence Initiative. But in Europe as a whole, I think we are seeing an increasing stratification, which has been around far longer in the U.S. So replication or duplication of this study in Europe, I think it would be very, very interesting.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, let us thank Stephanie again.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.